Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Jeannot, and you're listening to the New Books in African Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Bert Ingelera, lecturer at the Institute of Development Policy and Management, University of Antwerp. He's also the co-editor of Genocide, Risk and Resilience, an Interdisciplinary Approach. Today, we'll be discussing his new book, Inside Rwanda's Gacaca Courts, Seeking Justice After Genocide, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Professor Ingelera, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello.
I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so my name is Bert. I live in Belgium. As you mentioned, I'm a lecturer assistant professor at the University of Antwerp here in Belgium. I studied philosophy and anthropology at the University of Leuven. And I did my PhD in development studies at the University of Antwerp. Initially I studied philosophy, but then I moved to anthropology, and that's also where I got interested in what is also the topic of this current book and a number of other publications that I have. The topic of violence and genocides, and of course the legacy of violence and dealing with violence. So initially, after my studies, I was sort of an assistant, teaching assistant researcher in philosophy, but I got interested in especially also the more ethnographic approach, doing fieldwork, and especially related to these topics. At some point, I actually got the opportunity to be included in a research project on Rwanda. Initially, I was not really interested in Africa. I thought maybe to end up in Latin America or something. Rwanda, there was a research project interdisciplinary on the Rwanda genocides with the objective to understand how actually the genocide unfolded at the local level in very remote villages. So at that point, I managed to be included, and so I spent 3 months living on a Rwandan hill in a village. And at that point, I really got hooked, and so I wanted to continue after that experience doing research on this topic and on this region and on this country. And so I managed then to be included in other research projects that eventually led to a long period of research on Rwanda's way of dealing with the past, with its violent past, through the Gacaca Courts. So since 2004, I've been doing research on Rwanda on a number of topics, and also I've done research on other countries in the region, on Burundi, a little bit on Eastern Congo. But most of my research between 2004 and 2014 dealt with the legacy of violence in Rwanda through mainly the Gacaca Courts, which is the topic of this book, of course. So it's actually, the book is sort of the final conclusion or the result of that research that took several years.
Interesting. As you noted during our correspondence prior to the interview tomorrow, we're recording this interview on April 6th, and April 7th is actually the day that that commemorates the Rwandan genocide. Did you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, so indeed, so it's actually a very symbolical time, a period for Rwanda that has a lot of meaning. Of course, today we are April 6th, which is a bit of a complicated date in Rwandan history, because on April 6th, 1994, the plane of the president at the time, President Habyarimana, was shot down when it returned from a regional summit meeting in Tanzania. And so that was the start of, a three-month period of killings, genocide against the Tutsi population. Of course, all of that happened at the time in 1994 in a context of civil war in the context of the introduction of multi-party democracy. But every time of the year, in Rwanda and, of course, in other regions, well, other places in the world, there is a moment, especially 1 week of mourning, of commemoration of what happened in Rwanda during that period.
And so this leads us, I think, nicely into the early part of the book, right? Your first chapter is entitled From Genocide to Gacaca, and it actually begins by talking about this 100-day period that began on April 6th, in which estimates range from 500,000 to 1 million people were killed. In this chapter, you sort of talk about the RPF, that is the Rwandan Patriotic Front, that took power in July of 1994, and thereby ending the genocide. And in taking power, they were able in quite an unfettered way to set the post-genocide agenda, including the implementation of Gacaca. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about that, because I think there's a sort of popular countervailing narrative that suggests that Gacaca sort of percolated up from the bottom of society and was sort of this manifestation of the will of the people. And you suggest in this chapter that it was largely the will of the government, of the post-genocide government to implement this method of justice.
Indeed, so that's actually, well, in that first chapter that I provide a bit of historical background to the net, well, the Rwandan conflict and also the, let's say, the decision or the process that led to the decision to adopt or to modernize the Gacaca. So as I mentioned, the genocide took place in the context of a civil war, where the Rwandan Patriotic Front, actually starting the 1st of October 1990, had invaded Rwanda. So the Rwandan Patriotic Front was mainly composed of, let's say, descendants of Rwandans who had fled Rwanda earlier, that's in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The majority of these people, the big majority of these the people that made up the RPF were Tutsi. So Tutsi is the minority ethnic group in Rwanda, Hutu is the majority. And so the period of decolonization in Rwanda, period of independence, was not only a period of revolt against the colonial powers, but it was also a revolt against what at the time was sort of the ruling class, mainly composed of Tutsi. So they had to flee Rwanda, Hutu took over power, and that lasted like that until, let's say, the beginning of the 90s, until the descendants of the minority group living outside of Rwanda managed to actually organize themselves and had attacked Rwanda. So a very complicated story. This also explains to a certain extent why the Tutsi living inside Rwanda were targeted during the genocide, because they were seen as accomplices of the RPF who had attacked Rwanda. So while the genocide was happening, the civil war restarted because it ended, well, it was a bit suspended because of peace agreements that were never implemented. And so eventually, on July 4, 1994, the RPF took over power. So it led to a military victory by the RPF, completely defeating the regime that had been in power, dominated by Hutu. And so, of course, let's say the modality of this political transition implies, and that's not only in Rwanda, but it's something you see everywhere in the world, the nature of the outcome of a conflict will shape very much the nature of the transitional justice process that is going to follow. So it's not that there were two parties who had to negotiate about what they were going to do with the violence that had happened in the past. The RPF could set the agenda of how they were going to deal with the genocide, and of course also with the civil war. And so actually the years following the genocide, reconciliation was absolutely not on the table. It was a taboo subject. What the RPF wanted was accountability. So everyone that had done something during the genocide had to be held accountable for what he or she had done. Because after a violent conflict, of course, there are a number of options. There are a number of mechanisms available. Of course, tribunals, something we know since even, well, it started after the Second World War with the Nuremberg trials. Then you had more, let's say, the approach of a truth commission that you saw in Latin America and, of course, South Africa. And then, of course, during that period also, but, of course, trials, you had the number of international criminal tribunals, for instance, for ex-Yugoslavia. But these normally go for the big fish. So it's only the main commanders, the political leaders that are actually put on trial. Very expensive procedures. And the RPF wanted to actually prosecute everyone who had done something in the genocide. And again, this is comes with the fact that there was a military overthrow. And of course, it's justice is also a very political process. It makes sense, or it's also... a political decision to prosecute, your enemy, and especially to make sure that you yourself as a victor don't get prosecuted, that you don't need to go on trial. That definitely influenced the decision, of course, and that's also a bit how it was argued that. The genocide that against Tutsi that happened in 1994 actually was built on a long process of impunity, of crimes that were committed in Rwandan history, going back to the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. There was never had been any process of dealing with these issues. And so from the point of view of the RPF, it was also needed to establish to make sure that there was a break with this culture of impunity, and every single individual had done something, had to be somehow held accountable in order, of course, to prevent the recurrence of these things in the future. So there were a number of options considered, but they were actually starting from this policy, everyone who has done something needs to be put on trial. It was very complicated because there are many actually very informative and insightful studies that analyze how the genocide actually happened. And what is very puzzling about the Rwandan case is that normally these types of killings, mass violence, is executed by specialists in violence, militias, the military. But in the Rwandan case, the problem is that through a number of dynamics that are very complex, but very many ordinary people got involved in hunting down and killing eventually or stealing property of their own neighbors. So after the genocide, there were already 130,000 people in prison. And so if you based on calculations, how long would it take to prosecute these people, and also in the context of a justice system after the genocide that was completely destroyed, it would take over 100 years. So they had to find a different way. And at some point, the idea to use the gachacha was introduced, was debated, mainly among, of course, the elites who took over at the time, which maybe is the RPF and a number of lawyers. And so the idea of the gachacha, since pre-colonial times, had been a dispute resolution conflict that had always been used at the very local level of society. So Bajacha means justice on the grass. Actually, it refers to a plant, so grass that is so soft to sit on that people actually prefer to gather on that spot because it's soft. And so in pre-colonial times, the head of the lineages, when there was a conflict in society, they, in order to prevent that hatred would linger on, actually tried to bring people together and decide on how to deal with the conflict. The conflict could have been someone from a certain lineage has stolen a cow or something else, minor disputes. How are you going to deal with this? And the idea was never, or the objective was never punishment or truth or things like that, but to restore harmony. And that happens in something that became known as gachacha. And of course, the gachacha evolved over time as any institution. During the colonial period, there was actually a Western type of justice system that was introduced. And the gachacha roles that gachacha had changed a little bit. For instance, more important crimes, more severe crimes now had to be dealt with in the Western type of legal system. But at the local level, the gachacha continued to be used to deal with minor conflicts in the population and to restore harmony. And actually, also after the genocides, there are a number of reports that illustrate that immediately after the genocide, when actually the justice system was completely destroyed, that the gachacha was spontaneously solicited, but especially to deal with, to gather some information on what had happened during the genocide, and especially to deal with property crimes, so people who had destroyed things or who had stolen things. So, but all of this eventually led to the idea, okay, we have so many people involved, we want to prosecute, so hold people accountable. So let's try to modernize, so not use the gachacha as it existed, but use this idea of a sort of justice system that is completely decentralized in local villages. That is what we're going to do. We're going to modernize this gachacha, and we're going to put people on trial on the place there in these places, in the villages, where they have actually committed crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity. So that was then around the year 2000, something that has been adopted and then codified into law, and then eventually, after some pilot phases, was implemented nationwide in 2005.
And you go into some detail about this sort of, division of labor between the parallel courts, the gachacha courts, and ordinary courts in terms of what they were respectively responsible for as this process unfolded. Is there anything that you wanted to say about that, about the specific sort of mechanics?
Yeah. So the modernization of the gachacha is based actually on three cornerstones. So by designing the law, there are three, let's say, main ideas. One is the confession procedure. So the confession procedure basically means that someone alleged who has committed crimes can receive a reduction in a sentencing if he or she confesses. This was based on the idea that there was actually no or very little, material evidence of crimes committed. And of course, there was not the typical machinery of investigators making a case. So all of this had to be done in a different way. And the basic idea was that people would actually confess to their crimes in return of a reduction of punishment. So another principle was this popularization. So this is basically the old gachacha, where lay judges, so people who had no legal, let's say, training, who are actually simply inhabitants of the villages where the trials are going on, are presiding the proceedings. And so this is based on, well, they are chosen by the population based on the idea of being integrity, so on being a sort of living according to morally high standards. And then the last, let's say, principle is the categorization. So that's what you were referring to. So there were different levels of trials going on based on the nature of the crime or the alleged crime committed. So, for instance, they differentiated people or crimes had been someone who had incited to commit genocides, or when you had committed rape, so more severe crimes. These people who had confessed or were accused of these types of crimes would actually not be dealt with in Gacaca, but would go to the ordinary justice system. And then other types of crimes, so people who had killed or had been involved in killing, would deal with what is referred to as sector Gacaca. So a sector is actually similar to what is a village. And then there were a number of categories ranging from well-known murderers, ordinary killers, or people who had been involved in attacks but did not have had the intention to kill. And then there was a last category that was actually taking place at the cell level, and the cell is like a neighborhood in a village. And these tribunals, or these dimensions of Gacaca, dealt with property offenses. So the Gacaca basically had two dimensions to it. So the sector Gacaca dealt with crimes committed against humans, and then the cell Gacaca dealt with property crimes. And so it depended on whether you had confessed and when, and what type of crime you had committed. So then the law stipulates the range of penalties that could be handed out by the lay judges. And they had a small margin of maneuver to decide on, you know, if you were in this category and you have confessed, then we can give you either 20 or 24 years. If you're in a different type of category, in this type of court, we can give you, and you have confessed to your crime, for instance, we could give you 8 to 11 years. But of course, this was the idea. But the system remained, so these three principles continue to be relevant for the Gacaca throughout the period that Gacaca was operational. But the law changed a couple of times, especially also because once Gacaca, the process started to be, well, became operational in 2005, which in the first phase was information collection phase, where actually, at the local level in the villages, one first tried to compile the files against individuals based on ideally confessions, because that was the idea. And then it would go to a second phase, the trial phase. But based on once the process started, it turned out that so many people actually started to be accused of having committed crimes, so were suddenly accused. So there was a shift from the idea of people will confess to accusations. So, and also that increased dramatically the number of people accused in Gacaca. So over the years, I saw these numbers rise. So at some points, they were 850,000 cases. And then eventually, at the end of Gacaca, the official closing ceremony was in 2012. Almost 2 million cases actually had been processed by the Gacaca courts. So throughout the country, there were, thousands of trials operating. And in the process of a couple of years, they actually processed about 1 million people, most of them at the cell level with the property offenses. But quite a number, of course, so cases of manslaughter, of crimes committed against humans. But these numbers are extraordinary. And of course, it would mean, especially since most actually were accused, that many people would actually need to return to prison. And one of the reasons why Gacaca was actually introduced was that they wanted to empty the prisons. So they had to change the system while it was working, so the Gacaca laws, shifting more people to lower categories, introducing or giving a more prominent role to community service for people convicted of crimes, and then also introducing the sort of the suspension of the sentence. So, but this was basically the modernization of the Gacaca, was the this categorization according to crime, the fact that Gacaca could deal with, you know, crimes of genocide. The old Gacaca, so to speak, had only dealt with minor disputes in the population. And then these ideas of the confession and the popularization that, of the process throughout society. So these were the main principles.
Yeah, and so, and here I think it's really important to sort of underscore that your sort of stated objective in this book is to address this discrepancy between what Gacaca was supposed to do, right, in this sort of, in its design, this modernized Gacaca, and what it actually did, right, and sort of in the introduction you sort of talk about the fact that you really can't convey what modern Gacaca accomplished by focusing on the goals, and the goals were widely publicized by the government, by donors, by NGOs, and so on, including, I thought it was very interesting, you sort of discussed the role of public relations and a PR firm in sort of promulgating these sort of ideals. And but I just think that this is a good moment to underscore that you're really trying to address this this discrepancy in the book. Something else that I in so doing, right, so continuing with this with the discrepancy, you talk in the third chapter a lot about this idea of the what was supposed to be a confessional model was actually operating according to prosecutorial adversarial logic, and in point of fact, Gacaca actually was retributive at its core. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about that, and I guess maybe more specifically talk about that in terms of your actual field work and research, which was conducted in a very fraught context with certain constraints.
Yes, so maybe to combine with what you said earlier on, let's say at least one of the objectives of the book is indeed that the outcomes of the Gacaca, the modern Gacaca, remain contested. So what Gacaca actually did, what it was, there has been a lot of attention to it, precisely because it has been it was presented as a new model of dealing with the past, something that was more culturally appropriate, customary based. But the problem is, as you said, that the objectives of Gacaca are what initially Gacaca or the modern Gacaca was supposed to do. The objectives are now, when Gacaca is over, simply presented as the outcomes. Mm-hmm. So, meaning that it had to accelerate legal proceedings, that it had to eradicate culture of impunity, reconcile Rwandans, establish the truth, administer justice based on Rwandan custom. So all of these, if you listen to Rwandan officials, but also a number of academics. They simply equate these objectives with the outcomes. And I think there's something missing there, and that's really an empirically informed investigation, so to speak. And that's something that I'm actually trying, well, that I'm doing in the book or that I did in my research. And there I question a number or most of these objectives, or the fact that these objectives are also the outcomes. What is true, and that's what I already said, is one objective is without any doubt reached to the fullest, namely accelerating the legal proceedings. So in a very short time span, there is like almost 2 million cases being dealt with. Never ever anywhere in history something like that has been done. What remains to be examined for is the quality of the trials and what the Gacaca actually did. And so that's what I try to do, based on also a combination of research techniques. So over 32 months, I've spent in the Rwandan countryside observing systematically almost 2,000 Gacaca trials. So I took a more ethnographic approach living there, trying also to understand the context of the trials. In several places, because often also there are quite some studies on Gacaca, but some of them have been conducted in one place or at a specific moment in time. And so Gacaca actually had some variation depending on the place and depending on the moment when the trials were taking place. So I tried to include all of that in order to the extent or to the best of my possibilities to come to a more comprehensive insight in what Gacaca actually was. And so one of the things that I definitely based on that, let's say, systematic empirical approach, because not only in the case of Rwanda, but actually in what is called transitional justice in general, so dealing with the violence of the past, lot is being said or assumed based on normative ideas, and little is being done based on data-driven and evidence. And that's where I tried, in the case of Rwanda and in the book, to make a contribution, trying to identify what Gacaca actually was and what it actually accomplished. And one of the claims or one of my insights is that with this Gacaca, modern Gacaca, when people hear about it, it's the idea of a very restorative type of justice. People gather on the oldest tree in the village and they talk a bit and then they leave on. But that was not what it was. It was a very fictional experience, but that should not be a surprise because, of course, they're dealing with very delicate, experiences. But the way they did it, it was very retributive. It was a mixture of things, but the modernization of the Gacaca changed the initial logic of what Gacaca used to be in the past. So the idea of the old Gacaca had always been to restore social harmony in the population. And what the new Gacaca did was actually, and that's also in one of the chapters, chapter 4, where I actually analyzed the experience of dealing with Gacaca or participating in Gacaca through a number of techniques, and I also refer to other studies who have been conducted, is that the introduction of Gacaca in Rwandan society, in my data, in my, observations, but also in other studies, there's clearly an increase in trauma, an increase in fear, an increase in distrust, a polarization of society, actually along, especially in the beginning, often along ethnic lines, so Hutu against Tutsi. So, because you need to understand that, as I said, there was a shift from confession to accusation. So imagine we are in a court, well, anywhere, not even in a court situation, but imagine I have committed a crime and I confess, and you are the victim, and I confess to my crime, right? or I deny that I've done something and you accuse me. This is a totally different atmosphere, a totally different type of relationship. And you need to understand this is not in a courtroom where you have security forces nearby and afterwards where you go home in a totally different area of a city or of the country, but where people are actually neighbors. So the way Gachacha had to operate, so if you analyze the trial, and I have 2,000 transcripts that I analyzed, it's all about the forensic truth. It's who did where, what, and when, and with whom. And so it's a very typical crime, typical criminal approach, where many people actually were accused, but in a very localized situation where the next day it's people need to go to the market together, or where they, if someone is sick, they need to be transported. So, and that's also then later in the book what I analyze, why Gachacha unfolds or created the outcomes that, that it actually created. But it, especially in the initial stages, the experience of Gachacha was very, let's say, negative. This also actually got better over the years. I think there are a number of reasons. One, as I already said, so the institutional framework, the laws of Gachacha changed over time because too many people were sent to prison, but also because the governments saw that this created problems in the population. At some point, there were thousands of people fleeing to Burundi, afraid of Gachacha. So they could not continue doing this. So they had to reduce, let's say, the retributive approach that, or the more retributive logic of the Gachacha. And over time, and that's also something that you see in these, well, in my, let's say, insights and my findings, is that Gachacha also became a more positive experience for many people. Let's say that the outcome is actually mixed. So Gachacha did something for some people at some point. And often for people at different stakes in Gachacha, near the end, Hutu who had been accused, who had done something in the genocides, were actually, well, happy that they, through Gachacha, that they could leave prison, because many of them had spent years in prison, pre-trial detention without any, someone dealing with their case, so they could actually get out of prison because of Gachacha. Some survivors have found some consolation, some dimensions of the pardoning, the reconciliation that came through Gachacha. Not even what they did in Gachacha, but the fact that Gachacha brought people together in the community, a sort of ritual way, coming together every week, actually did something for some people. So the outcome is quite mixed. So also many Hutu continue to consider to Gachacha to be a sort of institutionalized injustice. It depends again on the place and the time. Many trials actually completely did not, did not have the legal safeguards of due process and other things, which means that, still I've seen trials where I could not understand the conclusion, how the judges have actually reached the conclusion to judge someone with a, so that there was no reasonable doubt to come to that conclusion, either acquitting someone or convicting someone. So it was a very imperfect, of course, procedure.
Yeah, and that's that is the sort of mixed success
And the conclusion, I have to say, and also, of course, and that was the idea, so that's what I wanted to do. My thinking or my insights evolved over time, and it's now, I hope, comprehensively presented in this book, taking into account also the variables of space and time. there is some mixed, let's say, conclusions about the outcomes of Gacaca. But in any case, so what I try to do is to question these cornerstones, the confessions of popularization and the categorization, and then, for instance, regarding the main objectives of Gacaca, whether a culture, if we analyze through these lenses, which I don't do systematically in the booklets, I mean chapter by chapter, but of course it is throughout the different chapters. One of the things that I question, for instance, also is whether a culture of impunity has been eradicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important point. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So throughout the book, and so in a number of chapters, I try to analyze why the Gacaca actually unfolded the way it unfolded. And one of the things that I identify is that, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, is that the genocide against Tutsi happened in the context of a civil war. So the RPF was, actually at war with the regime at the time, and this is a civil war in overpopulated countries, so there's lots of people who have been killed during the civil war, also by the RPF, who is currently in power. And in all the trials that I observed, there's never been anyone actually being put on trial for war crimes. Mm-hmm. So there were these war crimes, but there were also revenge killings by Tutsi civilians following the genocide. None of these people have been prosecuted. And again, it depends on where you actually were doing the Gacaca, so to speak. There are villages where this did not happen. There are villages, especially in the north, where this happened on a large scale. And for us, we have the bigger picture of the history, so to speak, and the severity of crimes. But for an ordinary peasant, and for one that is still a society of mainly farmers, subsistence farmers, who live somewhere in a village, you only know what happened to you and what happened to your village. And so it's difficult to understand why certain crimes are being dealt with and other crimes not. So definitely the Gacaca dealt with genocide and the genocide against Tutsi. But in theory, the scope or the competence of the law also left room to deal with war crimes. Mm-hmm. But systematically, it's difficult. And then we get to the dynamics that I also analyze in the book, is why are these crimes being excluded? So mm-hmm. That's what I did based on the years that I did this observation. Because many people think that authorities or the current regime they just intervened in the trials. But it was a much more, to, for instance, exclude these types of crimes, but it was a much more complicated process. So in the book, I also analyze how, let's say, the power structure that is currently in place, how people have actually internalized these ideas of what is currently true and what is not true, what is just and what is not just. And through a range of mechanisms, through a range of things that have been installed in Rwandan society, going over speeches by dignitaries that are being conducted every week, so to speak, in villages, over re-education camps, certain also violent reactions at time, putting people in prison. People actually have developed a sort of rehearsed consensus on what is true and what is not true. Mm-hmm. And this very much influenced what people dared to say in Gacaca and what they did not say in Gacaca. Mm-hmm. So that explains, for instance, why a certain number of crimes were not being dealt with in the Gacaca. And of course, this means that, yes, the culture of impunity has been dealt with to a certain extent. But on the other hand, there's another type of impunity that now has been introduced precisely because of Gacaca, an impunity for war crimes. And I don't want to equate war crimes with genocide. It's something totally different.
And I think that I'm glad you said that, because you do talk about it's important to make that distinction precisely because you talk about a systematic or a systemic rather tendency to find defendants guilty of genocide, crimes of genocide, but innocent of war crimes. And so if you could make that distinction clearer, that I think would be helpful.
Well, yeah, genocide, well, the crimes of genocide mainly means that it's a genocide, well, legally speaking, means that there is the intention to destroy in whole or in parts the members of a certain group. And that was what happened indeed during the, well, during these months, these 100 days in 1994. I mean, for me, there's no doubt that there was a project that was a clear, some people question this, I don't. Mm-hmm. There was a clear project to exterminate the Tutsi as a group at the time. But war crimes is, yeah, there's, and that's more on the side of Hutu, there's been a number of Hutu who have been killed during this period because they were actually friends of Tutsi or because they were actually part of the political opposition at the time, so actually considered to be more supportive of the RPF mm-hmm. At the time. But there is also Hutu after the genocide who, or let's say before 1994, especially in the north, there have been reports that during the civil war, the RPF was in combat with the Rwandan army, actually also killed a number of Hutu civilians. So all of this is actually war crimes or political crimes. The idea was not to exterminate the Hutu as a group, but these are crimes. In theory, Gacaca could deal with these things. In practice, it never did. And, the Rwandan authorities could say, well, yeah, you could go to the ordinary courts to deal with these things, but in all the places where I did research, these types of things happened, and when I asked around, people would never go to the ordinary courts to deal with this because they know they will never find, well, they will not be considered serious. These are the things that mm-hmm. are not being dealt with. These are the things that are being silenced in Rwandan society. Of course, they talked about in private between like-minded people. Right. So that's what I say. Of course, this is another type of impunity that currently is lingering on in Rwandan society, and it remains somewhere in the hearts of the people. And if it again, it introduces a sort of a distinction between people or. And I'm not saying this myself, but I'm analyzing the discussions and I had and the observations that, yeah, this idea of being different, Hutu and Tutsi, is being reinforced by these types of, let's say, state-imposed ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's... So there are a couple of... very interesting things there. One of the things that you just touched on, go into detail in the sixth chapter where you talk about Rwandans adopting a strategic stance toward Gacaca and really, which in part belies this notion of popular participation and a confessional ideal, among other things that you've discussed. But it also sort of looks forward, I think, to what you discuss toward the end. Well, actually, throughout the book, but also focus on toward the end, which is sort of this idea of truth, right? And you actually use, I think, sort of a typology of truth that the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission had used, right? So whether it's forensic truth, which you've already sort of discussed, but looking to see these other dimensions of the truth, the narrative, social, and restorative that go beyond these factual accounts of things that actually happened. I wonder if you could sort of discuss that a bit more in terms of, again, the field work that you did, your research methods, including observation and other mixed methods approaches.
Indeed. So, yeah. So the topic of the truth is actually something that is a recurring theme throughout the book. Also because, given the approach that I adopted, which is more inductive, having, let's say, insights emerge from, let's say, the data, the insights, I noticed that the truth was a very important but very complicated issue in Gacaca. And I think beyond the Rwandan case as well, what happened in the Gacaca can help us to understand the complexities of truth in general, but in a transitional justice context anywhere else in the world. And as you pointed out, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the report, the South African report, actually identifies a number of different types of truth. So we are most mainly familiar with the forensic truth, which basically is who did what, where, and when. This is also a bit the idea of the scientific truth, or it's the typical legal type of truth. But of course, the Truth Commission, that's also why there's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it has different types of truth, and the South African Commission identified the narrative dimension, which basically is more the subjective experience, the meaning attached to social truth, which is the truth embedded in social relationships. So all of that is interesting, but my experience with Gacaca, or my insights, point out, and that is precisely a bit more, of course, based on the extensive interviews I did, but also based on the observations that I, by living there, is that there were different types of truth at play in Gacaca. So, of course, the design of Gacaca, what Gacaca was supposed to accomplish by design, was the forensic truth. So that's why it's also very prosecutorial, adversarial, retributive approach. But there were other types of truth at play, and one of that is what I refer to as a truth with a capital T, which basically is what I explained earlier, namely how the current political context very much influences what can be said and what cannot be said. And this is not only a Rwandan phenomenon, of course. There have been analysis, something that what Foucault has actually introduced, the idea of regimes of truth. So there are political contexts, power situations, which makes him sound as true. I mean, it's also a bit going on everywhere else in the world, is the idea of trying to get your alternative facts try and pass as truths. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And then there's what I refer to as the effectual truth, is also a sort of a pragmatic type of truth, what I saw people do in the Gacaca. And we often do not consider pragmatic types of truths, but it basically means that truth is that which is actually the most useful in the given circumstances. So the pragmatic truth is also a sort of a theory of truth, which basically means that, you know, we consider something to be true if it gets things done, if it works. Mm-hmm. And many people in Gacaca, actually, this is how they approach Gacaca. So both from the side of the perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators and the victims, given the particular situation they were in, many of these people accused of having done something, or people who were in prison, actually calculated or looked at the best ways of getting out of this process, mm-hmm. To increase their own well-being in the short and in the long run. And what their well-being was is not necessarily finding justice or the truth, the actual truth of what happened. So it's about navigating the system to get the optimal outcome. And that could be getting out of prison, but it also could mean making sure that I'm not being socially excluded in my community here, mm-hmm. or that which often from the side of the victims was a sort of an approach they had to adopt, because often these are women who lost their family, and we're in an African village where the more hands you have in the family, the more you actually can advance in your life. You need to have someone who goes to fetch water, who helps you in working in the fields, and they have lost all of that. Mm-hmm. And so now they need to rely on their neighbors of some who are family members with maybe perpetrators. So they make very pragmatic choices of, it's not going to, telling the truth here in Gachacha. It's, the real truth, so to speak, the objective truth, the forensic truth. It's not going to help me. I'm going to let this pass, and maybe I get some compensation from the family of the perpetrator that will help me in my current situation that I'm living in. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that these people don't want justice, but they have to take very pragmatic decisions. And to a certain extent also, this for them, this is can be justice, not going to prison, but giving something back. And that's also what I saw. And then we go back to the initial logic of the Gachacha, the old Gachacha, so to speak. That was more the restoration of harmony that often happened through a sort of a gift. You give something, and that through that you try to reestablish the relationship. And so these trials dealing with property cases, on the one hand, they were the most difficult often because there was really a lot of stake at stake. But also the most promising if it really worked out, because promising in terms of reestablishing social relationships between people, because there was actually a sort of an exchange that had a symbolic meaning to it that resonated well with ideas or images existing in Rwandan culture, and going back also on the foundations of the old Gachacha. Because this is also then another dimension of the truth that I analyze, and that's what I'm referring to as the moral truths. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I also observed by closely analyzing the transcripts and paying attention to the language is that Rwandans speak in a specific way about the experience of the violence and how to deal with it, often referring to very complicated, complex concepts like umutima, which basically means, could be translated as heart, but it's a very complicated concept, and it refers to the idea of the person, the individual, the self. And what they want to see is actually what they often say is that the heart has changed, which basically means that an individual has changed, so the moral character of someone has changed because of the violence he or she has committed or he or she has experienced. And they want this to change, the moral character. They want to have signs that someone is actually changing again. And what can be these signs? Often these are things that are in line with, as I said, ideas in the Rwandan culture. There are tokens of sharing beer, providing a helping hand, being invited to a ceremony, an exchange of goods. These are all signs of the moral, let's say, qualities of people. And of course, these also happen to a certain extent in Gachacha, but to a great extent, Gachacha, because it was modernized and the logic changed, to a great extent went against the grain of these, let's say, ideas of what justice is and what the person is and how we can establish reconciliation.
It's really Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that you do discuss, I should point out for the benefit of listeners, that you do discuss sort of these complex and evolving notions of personhood in some detail in the book. And that's a very important point. I think I was also struck by this idea of the strategic positioning vis-a-vis the truth, right? This practical approach that I think mirrors, that's mirrored rather in your approach to your research, which you actually aligned with the Aristotelian notion of phronesis, which I thought was very interesting. Again, sort of practical and pragmatic turn. And I wonder if we could sort of begin a conclusion of our discussion by talking about precisely that, why you took this approach. And if I may, I'll quote directly from the book where you say, in the aftermath of mass violence and in times of transitional justice, the field is riddled with a range of obstacles that demand a practical understanding of how to navigate the terrain. So if you'd talk about that and also what sort of lies beyond this particular case in terms of transitional justice beyond Rwanda, the Rwandan case.
Mm-hmm. Well, starting with, let's say, the approach and indeed the problem that after violence and in the context of transitional justice process, it is of course complicated to gather trustworthy insights, precisely because you're often in a very fragile environment. Of course, every context is a bit different, but I can imagine that it's very similar in similar situations around the world where people have gone through extreme violence. It means, of course, that people are very careful in what they're saying to whom. And this has implications for research, of course. Not only the violence, but often also the political situation influences what people can say. And for the Rwandan case, this is definitely also an issue, which is a pretty authoritarian environment at this point for a number of reasons, but which basically means, of course, also that, and it's all the things also analyzing where I provided the context to understand, to give an idea of the context in which the Gacaca tried to operate. But all of that has implications on how you go about doing research. And for me, I adopted a number of, let's say, principles, as I already hinted at the fact that I wanted to, let's say, have an insight in the process, the evolution over time, which meant continuous observations of Gacaca in several places, but also the issue of process. I tried to get at it through life story interviewing. And the life story interview was also interesting. I did that in a systematic way, because the life story is also sort of an indirect way that people talk about, sensitive issues in the context of Rwanda or complicate legacy of violence. If you would ask them very direct questions, so what do you think about, you know, the other ethnic group and things like that, and yeah, you would get politically correct answers. Another approach was, of course, being there. So I tried to establish a rapport, trust with these people by returning several times over several years, where they saw that the nature of our interactions that we had had earlier and what they had said, that there were no consequences. I was also very careful in making sure that there would not be negative, let's say, repercussions for people, or that I would introduce a sort of conflictual dynamic between people by using information I had from someone. So it's all walking on eggs a little bit. And then another thing is, let's say, the combination of different research techniques. For instance, given this type of context, if you would do survey research at a very large scale with the typical survey approach and survey questions, of course, I'm not saying it's not impossible, but it can be a bit problematic depending on how you do it, how you introduce yourself in the field, who is doing the actual interviews, what the nature of the questions is. So there I try to come up a range of techniques from, as I said, being there, observation, systematic observation of trials, interviews, but also survey techniques, and in a way that, on the one hand, somehow certain techniques informed, let's say, the construction or the elaboration of other techniques or approaches. Sometimes I did very unstructured, let's say, data gathering. Sometimes I did it in a very structured way. And the combination of all of that, I think, provides a more layered, a more complex insights in, let's say, all the dynamics going on. Beyond Rwanda, I think what the Gacaca experience shows, of course, that there has been, I mean, we should be realistic about it. Transitional justice, dealing with the past, is always going to be a very painful process and unfortunately always going to be imperfect. I don't think there's an ideal solution to approach possible. Of course, there were high hopes for something like the Gacaca. As I said, initially the model was tribunals, then you had, let's say, the model of the Truth Commission, and then there were these more cultural approaches, very localized way of doing things. And Gacaca is often being presented as the example of such an approach. I think what we should learn, of course, and there is a lot of attention to the local, going local in transitional justice, in peace building, and but we should be aware that the local is not some kind of a romantic place where everything is always nice and good. I think in the book and the way people approach the Gacaca is I show that there's lots of also very strategic, let's say, things going on. In terms of the Gacaca, beyond Gacaca, it also shows that it's actually difficult to modernize something traditional. I mean, if I put in a very simple way like this, any type of intervention will make something into something new, which is not necessarily better.
Right.
So the idea of the Gacaca is that it definitely did bring together two worlds, the traditional conflict resolution mechanism, and it did bring together the modern legal system and some of the ideas that exist in the global justice system. But I think also, and the idea is automatically that this then becomes something better. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can also bring, the worst of two worlds together. So the Gacaca also shows that, for instance, what I think was a strength of the old Gacaca was this conciliation, the restoration of harmony, but that was not there anymore, or it was there to a lesser degree. and what is the strength of the modern legal system, it's the safeguards of due process. And that was not there either in the Gachacha. So I am also the Gachacha. I had to do so many things at the same time. Hold people accountable, bring reconciliation, establish the truth. These are all very complicated things, and it's very difficult for one mechanism to do all these things at once. These are very contradictory objectives at times, so I'm also more in favor for a more, let's say, complementary approach where not one mechanism needs to do everything at once.
Right.
Of course, this happened to a certain extent in Rwanda as well. You also had the criminal tribunal for Rwanda dealing with the big fish in the ocean. But still, I think Rwanda could also have had a genuine truth commission that dealt with other types of truth than the forensic truth. Or you have different projects going on in Rwanda as well, or that I see everywhere else around the world, that are more in line with, say, the really cultural logics of people that are really based on ideas of local ideas of personhood. And I think the combination of all these different things can be more productive in a society that deals with violence. And generally speaking, also this implies a step further than looking at culturally appropriate mechanisms or institutions or local institutions. Actually, we need to examine better the ideas of what justice means in different societies, what the law actually means, what the living law is of a society, what truth is, what reconciliation is. So, again, this does not imply, because that's sometimes the argument you get when you want to pay attention to more cultural, let's say, meanings, or we should be aware that we don't essentialize people and attract their cultures. That's true, but it doesn't have to apply an essential way of looking at people. But we cannot deny that people are somehow, as Clifford Geertz at some point said it, they're not trapped in the cultural cage, but they are suspended in a web of meanings. So we should better understand these meanings, what it means to be, to find justice, to seek truth, what truth means in different contexts. So I think that actually the paradox of the Gachacha and the Rwanda case, because it's often seen as something that is very much adapted to the cultural context, where my claim is that it actually went against the grain of this cultural context in a certain way. And I think there's more to be done there in a genuine understanding of the cultural, or let's say the foundations of what it means to live together, what justice means in different societies that try to deal with with the legacy of violence.
Well, I think that is a really great summary of the book's project. And I really, again, appreciate you coming on today to discuss it with me. Can you let us know what you are currently working on, or if you have any upcoming projects?
I'm working on a number of things. So, of course, it's a bit, on the one hand, a bit a continuation of, let's say, this topic or this theme, but then broader. I've also been doing fieldwork in a systematic way in Burundi, which is a neighboring country of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. It's a very similar history, ethnic makeup. Unfortunately, also violent history for the moment is also in a crisis. And so I've been collecting systematically both in Rwanda and Burundi, also over time and through a number of techniques, insights in, let's say, the long-term transformation of the experience of trust, of fear, security, ideas of political representation, mm-hmm. by people who have actually gone through this experience of violence. So in the long run, what are actually the ways that if and how do people start to trust each other again? What happens with feelings of security or fear? So that's something I'm analyzing now, but comparing Rwanda and Burundi in a systematic way, and I can do a number of other things in related to this approach. I'm interested in ethnicity, of course, and how ethnic relationships change over time, what kind of categories lose salience, become more salient over time in these types of societies. So that's, let's say, the main project I'm working on. I have some smaller issues. So after this, let's say, bigger project on Rwanda, I had to get out of it a little bit. So I'm also involved in a project now on something totally different, mainly migration, with a focus on Tanzania. So why people migrate to small towns, secondary towns, or to the capital city. And I got involved because actually it's also life history approach, where through life histories I'm trying to understand the changes in people's lives, the decisions that people make. And then there are a number of smaller projects, something on sexual violence in Congo. But let's say this evolution over time of the experience of trust, of fear, security, political representation, that's one of the main things I'm doing now.
Well, I certainly look forward to hearing about how all of those projects, which none of which sounds small, evolve. Really, I'm looking forward to following your work. So thank you again for coming on the podcast. Listeners, we've had the pleasure of talking today with Professor Nyilare, of the whose book, Inside Rwanda's Gacaca Courts, Seeking Justice After Genocide, is published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And we will speak to you next time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.